100 million people around the world are now displaced. War, violence, persecution, and rights abuses are some of the main causes. But can this rising trend be reversed? And if so, how? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. More people than ever before are being forcibly displaced around the world. And according to the UN Refugee Agency, either we deal with the causes, conflict, climate change, and persecution, to name just a few, or we begin accepting a world in which millions are displaced everywhere. Right now, that figure is more than 100 million. The war in Ukraine is worsening the situation, displacing more than 12 million people in less than 4 months. We'll bring in our guests in a moment. First, this report from Charles Stratford in Kyiv.
Yulia and Ludmila escaped the Russian bombardment of Mariupol on March the 19th. Over the next few days, they risked their lives 3 times driving back into the city, braving bullets, shells and airstrikes in a desperate attempt to find the father of their family, 61-year-old Oleksandr Pilipenko. They fear he never made it out.
We were driving. There were Russians on one side, Ukrainians on the other, and they were shooting, says Yulia. We were in the middle. It was terrifying. But we were determined to get Dad.
The family used to live near the Azov steel plant, where an estimated 2,500 Ukrainian soldiers and civilians were trapped for weeks. As the fighting intensified, they fled to a basement under a block of flats in the city centre. On the day they escaped, the shelling was intense, and Oleksandr never made it from the basement to the waiting civilian car. We were sure he knew we would come back for him, says Ludmila, and he would wait for us in the basement. A few days later, they returned to where they had last seen Oleksandr. We saw all the buildings were burnt and destroyed, says Ludmila, and there was no one there. Ludmila and Yulia's story is not uncommon. The United Nations estimates that Russia's invasion has forced more than 12 million people to flee their homes. The Ukrainian government says thousands of them are searching for friends and loved ones missing, feared dead. Anna Chazovnikova is a psychologist, volunteering at a centre helping some of the tens of thousands of people from Mariupol who fled to the Ukrainian-controlled side.
Today I had a lady whose husband was killed in front of her, and she asked, why did I survive? She, like so many, is deeply disturbed, constantly breaking down and refusing to accept what has happened.
Families who come to this center receive food parcels once every 2 weeks. Children play while their parents register and tell their stories to volunteers. Andrei used to work at the Azov-style plant as a lathe operator. He says he left many friends behind.
I think they are more sympathetic to the occupiers. They call me and ask, when are you coming back? But I will never return with Russians in control.
Anastasia was a social worker in Mariupol before the war. She struggles to hold back her tears.
We all lost friends. They're gone forever. In my case, it would have been death or captivity because I refused to work under the occupiers. I don't know if I will ever see my city again.
The Ukrainian government accuses Russia of forcing tens of thousands of people from Mariupol into Russia, an accusation Russia denies. Yulia and Ludmila say their only hope is that Oleksandr is still alive. Charles Stratford, Al Jazeera, Kyiv.
Every year of the past decade has seen a rising number of people forced to flee their homes. This year is no different. A new high for displacement, above 100 million for the first time. The UN Refugee Agency says the scale and speed of this crisis is outpacing solutions. The biggest factor right now is the war in Ukraine, which has triggered one of the largest mass displacements since the Second World War. But there is some good news. 5.7 million people returned to their countries of origin last year. All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guests in Geneva. Shabia Mantu is a spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency. In Oxford, Nando Sigona, professor of international migration at the University of Birmingham and director of the Institute for Research into Superdiversity. And in Invercargill, New Zealand, Behruz Buchani is an author and former refugee. A warm welcome to you all, and thank you so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Behruz, let me start with you today. When we talk about the displacement crisis in the world today, we must talk about something that's been in the news a lot, especially this week. It's this very controversial plan in the UK. There's this agreement between the British government and Rwanda in which some refugees and asylum seekers would be sent to Rwanda to have their asylum claims processed there. Now, many who oppose this plan say that the plan mirrors Australia's use of offshore detention centers. That was a plan that saw people being sent to detention centers on the Pacific islands of Nauru and Manus. You yourself were held at an offshore detention center on Manus Island for 6 years. So how concerned are you about the kind of precedent this UK-Rwanda agreement could set?
Thank you for having me. I think it's horrific news. And for many years, we in Manus Island and also the advocates, human rights defenders and journalists in Australia were warning that what is happening in Australia and what the Australian government is doing one day will be a model for other countries. And I remember like 5 years ago, some politicians came from Danish, from Denmark, and they visited Nauru. And when they went back to Europe, they exactly established the same system in Denmark. But in UK is a big, is a large version of Australia, and exactly is same. And let me to say that the former Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott was exactly the same person who introduced this policy to British politicians, and now they are doing that. And this policy is established on secrecy, on uncertainty, and also on based of colonialism mentality. So what they are doing is exactly same as what Australia has done. And unfortunately, I'm very negative about this, and I think they are going to do this. So now they stop it, but I don't think that the courts or human rights defenders or civil society in UK are successful to stop them to do this. But it's really, I'm really worried about that because I went through a same system and I know the soul of this system, that how is cruel and how is inhuman, and also how this policy impact on political culture and actually undermine the principles such as humanity and human rights and democratic values. So, of course, I'm just following that news, and hopefully they don't do it, but I'm quite negative about it, and I think they will do it because this kind of policy allowed the populist politicians to manipulate public and get power. So we already seen that in Australia, and we know the outcome of that, that how many people keep under this system and how this system is corrupt.
Shabia, you and I have spoken many times in the past about the numerous displacement crises in different parts of the world. But we are at a moment now where there are 100 million people worldwide that have been forced to flee their homes in the past year. That is the highest number of displaced people recorded since World War II. And that is staggering by any measure. I wonder if you could speak to our audience about the enormity of this number and what this means.
Indeed, this is a very stark figure. It's very sobering and alarming in equal measure. Each year we've seen worldwide forced displacement increase, and we have seen these records just being met and even topped year on year. They're just really exponentially increasing. Now, it's a very worrisome picture, but there's a direct link between worldwide forced displacement and conflicts and persecution and humanitarian emergencies that continue to drive people from their homes. So what we're seeing is a picture around the world of people having to flee in the face of conflict and insecurity. So we're advocating for solutions. Otherwise, these numbers will continue. But more importantly than that, behind these numbers, these are human beings. Each one of those is a human person with a life ahead of them. And it's a really tough ordeal to be living in a state of displacement. So we are calling for solutions to resolve the situations that force people to flee and to prevent them from becoming displaced in the first place. And just one last thing to add, when we look at these statistics, it's also worth bearing in mind that the majority of these people, we've reached 100 million, in fact, this year, but we've just released a report today called the Global Trends Report, which looks at worldwide forced displacement of the previous year. Last year, at the end of 2021, we had about 89.3 million people worldwide that were forcibly displaced. Now, 83% of those are being hosted in low to middle income countries around the world. So we're also seeing a great inequity in terms of the responsibility sharing for the world's forcibly displaced people.
Nando, you heard Shabia speak there about the link between forcible displacement, forced displacement, and conflict. And UNHCR is saying that the trend in the rising numbers of those being displaced can only be reversed by a new concerted push towards peacemaking. But given the state of the world today and given how many conflicts there are in the world right now, does it seem likely to you that we will see that push, that we would see that concerted effort by the international community?
I don't think so. I mean, at the moment, what we see is that it's a sustained attack on refugee protection internationally. You know, you mentioned at the beginning the Rwanda plan of the British government. One of the reasons why the plan is really concerning is that if it passes, it can become a template for other countries. And what it does is basically saying that the rich Western countries can simply offshore their responsibility vis-a-vis refugees. This is not just what we saw in the past. It was, for example, offshoring the asylum claim. So asylum claims were assessed outside the country, but then people were transferred towards Western destination. In this case, the novelty of it is that basically the UK is transferring asylum seekers for being assessed by a third country. And even in case they are successful, they stay there. They have no right to move to the UK. So what we see is sustained attack on the system that was built with the Geneva Convention 70 years ago.
Behrouz, you know, in the past few months, there's been a lot of sympathy that's been shown to Ukrainian refugees. And of course, that's a good thing. All refugees should be given safe harbor. But the fact that there are so many refugee crises going on around the world, and the fact that there are so many refugees in various parts of the world who don't get nearly the same amount of help and aid and attention, how does that make you feel? And how does that make the refugees that you're speaking to regularly feel?
I think, you know, I'm in touch with many refugees in Indonesia. At least 14,000 refugees are in Indonesia, and they have been waiting for almost a decade. And thousands of refugees who live in Turkey, so I'm in touch with some of them, and just around the world. And I think that is, of course, that some countries, they welcome refugees from Ukraine, and that is great, so we should appreciate that. But unfortunately, there is a discrimination here, and you know, according to international law, you are not allowed to do that. So refugees are refugees, so it doesn't matter where they come from, and doesn't matter even what is their skill, what is their background. And that's why, you know, these refugees that I'm in touch with them, they always are worried, and they sometimes get angry about it. And even in Germany, we hear, I think it was 2 months ago, that, kick out the Afghan refugees and gave their accommodation to refugees from Ukraine. And now in UK, we see that they treat refugees from Ukraine differently. And now they are banishing refugees to Rwanda. And I think there is something wrong there. And of course, I don't know that we say it's racism or not, but obviously there is a discrimination, and that is not acceptable according to the law. And also, we should ask this question, that why we help refugees, why we let them stay, why we process them and let them to start a new life, because of principles, because we believe and we think that we should believe in morality and humanity. And so when we understand it in this way, I really don't understand it, why they treat refugees differently, and that is not acceptable, and that make refugees feel bad about it. You know, there are thousands and thousands of refugees who have been waiting to settle in a third country, and that is obviously that is not acceptable.
Shabia, I want to talk a little bit about some remarks that were made by your boss and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi. He had said that the European Union's response to the Ukrainian refugee crisis has been unequal, and that he would like all refugees to be afforded the kind of generosity that Ukrainian refugees have been granted. But that's not really what we're seeing, is it? I mean, there are many refugees and refugee crises in other parts of the world that are being largely ignored, right?
Well, I think the global picture is a mixed one. I think firstly we have to recognize obviously the response to the Ukraine refugee crisis. We saw a tremendous outpouring of solidarity, a tremendous outpouring of support, and so we do commend the quick steps and the commitments that were made to respond to that crisis. It shows that when you have that resolve, and when you have the political will, it is possible to respond to situations of mass displacement. And I think that's the message we'd like to see for all other crises. They're also deserving of the same attention and support. You have many of those around the world, and many of those are also neglected or forgotten. So we do need, we're asking for an extension of that compassion and that solidarity. But as Vahra has mentioned, you know, the right to seek asylum, it's a fundamental human right. It's a legal obligation. So it's really important that refugees, no matter where they're come from, that they're able to access that safety and protection and receive their rights and entitlements that they deserve. But we also have to look at the global picture. If we do look at the response to many refugee crises around the world, it is predominantly the neighbouring or the regional countries that do step up. They're often at the front lines. They're the first responders, that you might say, in terms of dealing with them. And if we look at the statistics, for instance, for the report that we issued just today, at the end of last year, we had, the largest refugee host countries were countries like Turkey, Colombia, Uganda, Pakistan, and so on. And these are countries that are neighbouring those where we do have humanitarian situations, and we do see those outflows. So we also recognise the tremendous solidarity that has been displayed by those countries. And it's not unique in the case of the Ukraine situation.
And Shabia, just want a quick follow-up question for you. Are there glimmers of hope right now? Are there examples of countries and communities that are working together to find solutions to help the displaced?
Indeed, they are. I mean, if we look at the response of some of these neighbouring refugee host countries, they've kept their borders open even during the height of the pandemic. They were receiving refugees. I mean, this is precisely why the refugee and global displacement figure has gone up every year. It's because those countries that are neighbouring these crises, they have received those refugees and displaced people. So we must also recognise that. And you've got countries like Colombia and Ecuador granting temporary protection directives or statuses which enable people who are displaced on their territory to benefit from their rights and residency and services. But you have remarkable, many, many examples of solidarity and compassion exemplified by many countries that are hosting refugees. And it's also important to remember that despite the grim outlook in terms of displacement, we saw about 5.7 million displaced people returning to their homes or their countries of origin as well in 2021. So that is also quite remarkable that they were able to return home voluntarily.
Nando, I saw you nodding to some of what Shabia Fabio was saying, so I'm going to give you an opportunity to jump in. But I also want to ask you, from your perspective, how disproportionately are women and children being impacted by the rising number of conflicts around the world this past decade? These are already vulnerable populations. How much more vulnerable have they become when it comes to forcible displacement?
In terms of the Ukrainian response compared to others, I mean, as it was just mentioned, traditionally, the crises are dealt in the regions. I mean, this has been one something that we have seen over the last decades. If you want to compare the response to Ukraine, you can, for example, look at the response to the war in Yugoslavia, the dissolution of Yugoslavia, where we're mostly EU member states that provided support for the refugees from the civil war in Yugoslavia. So it's true that not all refugees are treated the same, that's for sure, but it's also true that very often it's the neighboring countries that are the ones that take the bulk of the responsibility, and that this is what we are seeing now in terms of the response to the Ukrainian crisis. We are seeing also this generous response partly because the European Union has learned from the experience of the refugee crisis of 2015-16. They have learned that by closing the border, they will only create tensions, they will create instability. You remember, you know, the what happened when, you know, with the borders of Hungary, so the construction of the walls, etc. Mm-hmm. So in many ways allowed the flow of people out, also enabled to release some of the tension that is normally produced in this situation of crisis. The main issue that we need to consider is there is a huge pressure on local communities at the moment. You know, they are receiving hundreds of thousands of people in some cases. For how long this is sustainable is one of the issues. Mm-hmm. What is going to happen at the end of the temporary protection is another issue that we will need to pay attention to. In terms of the vulnerable groups, there are groups that have been, as we've seen also with the Ukrainian crisis, very often, especially in the first part of the conflict, this was basically was mostly women and children, elder people that crossed to outside the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. We've seen that sometimes very often there are experiences of violence, of exploitation in these processes, in crossing the border. Sometimes also a research show show us that in the way that the smuggling services operate, they often women are particularly vulnerable to sexual and gender violence, for example, as the research we carried out at the University of Birmingham has shown.
Behrouz, we only have a couple of minutes left. I want to give you the last word here. I've heard you speak in the past very, very powerfully about the kind of trauma that refugees and the displaced deal with, especially when it comes to those who have escaped violence. They've made it to a new country, but then they just have to wait. They have to wait to find out if they can get asylum or when they'll be able to set up a new life. Could you tell our audience a little bit about that kind of trauma?
I think, you know, I already wrote about this in some articles that particularly Australia, how they have been torturing refugees through time, you know, just keeping refugees in limbo. And so just keep refugees waiting for many years to get a resettlement in a third country. That is a really huge torture because this living in limbo, living in a situation like undecided situation is really impact on refugees. And they cannot imagine future. They cannot really think about their future. And also they lose many things, you know, refugees left their countries. And of course they, for example, now with Afghan refugees, they have families back home and they want to support them, but they cannot, you know. And this keeping people just waiting, that really create problem and the refugees feel tortured. But some refugees or many refugees actually, they left their countries because of persecution, many of them because of discrimination, you know, and when they come to West, you know, they go through a difficult process again. And of course, that is, you know, they have to endure a kind of trauma again. And for example, with women especially, some of them, they leave their countries because of sexual violence, but they find themselves in a camp or in a places like that, and they get raped again, you know, or sexual assault. So, I mean, that is really difficult to describe it, but keeping refugees in a situation, in an undecided situation for many years, that is, of course, damage refugees mentally. And I think, I don't know when they get freedom, how they want to, you know, get away of that or start a new life.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Shabia Mantu, Nando Sigona, and Behrouz Bouchani. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here in Doha, bye for now.